DNA testing in our lives and society. It's estimated that more than 26 million people have had their DNA tested in recent years, mainly through the companies Ancestry and 23andMe. Many people do these tests out of curiosity about their family tree, and even when they don't expect it, find out surprising things about their families, such as adoptions and paternity issues. In medicine, genetic testing is used to assess the risk for certain cancers and other diseases. And in law enforcement, DNA is increasingly relied on to help solve crimes. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll discuss all of these uses for genetic testing, and we'll also delve into some of the privacy and ethical issues this technology raises. Maine Calling is next. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. DNA testing is in the news, linked to some high-profile criminal cases. It has also changed the way we learn about our risk for disease and other health issues, and it is used extensively now to learn about our ancestry as well. Today, we will talk about what genetic testing can reveal and what you might do with the information you learn. Joining me in the studio, Dr. Susan Miesfeldt. She is a medical oncologist and cancer risk researcher at Maine Medical Center. Kimberly McLaughlin is a nurse and DNA genealogy researcher. And Brandy Caron is a DNA analyst with the Maine State Police Crime Lab. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you had your DNA testing? If so, what were you trying to learn and what did you learn? Do you have questions about the results? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today, and what an interesting topic. I know every time we bring this up, even here at the station, even here in Maine Public, people are buzzing. It's so many layers to think about. So I want to start with you, Dr. Miesfeldt. I think the last time we talked was a decade ago, and that's just when people started looking at the BRCA gene for certain types of breast cancers. What's available now? What kind of genetic testing is available to patients?
There are thousands of genetic tests available in medicine now, broken down into obviously disease risk and disease management, but there are many genes yet to be discovered. And when you think about genetic testing, it falls into several different categories. First is relative to breast cancer, hereditary breast cancer, there's diagnostic testing. So for example, if someone comes to us with a new breast cancer diagnosis and has other risk factors for hereditary disease, we'll oftentimes offer genetic testing to determine whether that breast cancer is hereditary or not. There's also carrier testing, which we do testing for recessive conditions. What a recessive condition is you have to get two bad copies of that particular marker. So if a couple is starting a family, they'll sometimes do carrier testing to determine whether each of them has a bad copy of that marker and determine risk for the next generation. An example of that sort of testing is cystic fibrosis testing that we do standardly in the United States. There's also prenatal testing. So for a pregnant couple, they'll sometimes do testing during that pregnancy to determine whether that pregnancy has a specific disease. There's emerging pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which we can actually test embryos. So those embryos, we have to use assisted reproduction, and we can then test the embryos and the unaffected embryos. So this is for a couple with a known genetic condition, a high-risk genetic condition. They implant those healthy embryos. And then finally, there's predictive testing, which is the area that I'm involved with, where a healthy person may come in to determine whether they may be at risk for a hereditary condition. And again, examples would be hereditary breast cancer, hereditary colon cancer, neurologic diseases like Alzheimer's, Huntington's disease. So there are a number of different diseases that we can do predictive testing so that that individual knows their risk and can take appropriate steps.
For all these different kinds of uses for DNA testing, are they more common and are they less expensive every year?
What's happened is that back when we spoke about 10 years ago, we only knew several high-risk genes associated with breast cancer. So what's happened with emerging basic research is other genetic markers have been found related to a number of different diseases. So what's happened, it's not that there's more testing, it's just that more of those markers are known and the testing is more extensive. So 10 years ago, we would have just looked at the BRCA genes, whereas now when we have a woman coming in at risk for hereditary breast cancer, the panel may be as big as 18 to 25 genes rather than just the two.
I'm sorry, it used to be a very small percentage of breast cancers. Is it now a greater percentage of breast cancers?
No, it still is. So about 7% of breast cancer
is hereditary.
It's just we know more of the markers, so the testing is more effective now in terms of determining those markers. And in terms of expense, the expense has come down significantly. Used to be several thousands of dollars, and oftentimes insurance did not cover testing. Nowadays, the cost has come down. Insurance is more open to testing, and the testing laboratories are very generous. So if insurance doesn't cover the testing, the out-of-pocket expense that's charged to the patient is very low.
Mm. Brandy, it's so exciting to have you here. I think a lot of people have an idea from watching TV shows like Criminal Minds and shows like that about what goes on in a crime lab. Give us a reality check. What happens at the Maine State Crime Lab, and how is DNA used there?
The crime lab is tasked with examining evidence from all types of different types of criminal activities, criminal investigations, and all cases that we work on have to be criminal in nature. We spend a lot more time actually doing paperwork and writing reports and taking notes than you would ever see on television. That's the reality of our job, is the documentation of the types of evidence that we're examining.
How has DNA changed the kind of work that happens at the Maine State Crime Lab and at labs throughout the country?
Well, the advent of DNA technology in the field of forensics and crime scene investigation has changed everything, just in terms of how available it is, because everyone is constantly shedding skin cells, potentially leaving DNA evidence behind. It's virtually impossible to commit a crime, interact with another person or a place, for example, a crime scene, and not leave part of yourself behind. And it's that piece that we're looking for, whether it's a cigarette butt, an area that they touch, finger smudge, smears that are swabbed. All of those things can lend themselves for developing a complete DNA profile that can be compared for analysis.
And this is all very recent, right?
We began our crime laboratory, our DNA section within the lab in the late 1990s, and it has significantly changed over the years in terms of the sensitivity of the testing that we use and the applications in the forensic databases and things of that nature.
All right. Kimberly, talk about DNA in genealogy. This is probably the most common use of DNA tests, especially the kits people send away for. What can they tell us and what can't they tell us?
Well, the genealogy tests that you can take will tell you more about your ancestry. And what they do is they do autosomal testing, which will tell you all of your ancestry. And so it can lead you in directions while doing your family history research that you may not have thought of, because now you have a genetic link. So it's very helpful. It's another tool that's in the toolbox for any genealogist to go ahead and, you know, find those connections and say, oh, you know, that might fill out a brick wall that you had. And there are several testing companies, and each one of them does something a little different. And it depends on what you want to know as to which one you might choose. Like Ancestry is a large database, and that is all autosomal testing, which will give you a broad sense of where your family tree and many, many matches of family members.
And most of that is about Ancestry in terms of what country you might be coming from, correct?
That is one of their products. Yes, they will tell you about
your
origins.
Oh, that's only one of the products.
And plus, well, but also they will tell you your matches, people that you match, and it could be down the street, it could be Australia, it could be anywhere. But people that you genetically match with, they also will give you that information. But then Ancestry also has their research thing as well, where you can build your family tree, and use their databases to find census reports and things to go along with and to confirm perhaps things. It might go in reverse order. You may have ideas from census reports, and then the DNA will either confirm or deny that theory. So in each company does something a little different, but Ancestry has those components where you can build a tree, use their research database. But then there's others as well, like Living DNA, which is out of England, which is basically they do just, you know, the UK and Northern Europe. There's also Family Tree DNA, where people who might be interested in Y DNA, which is just the male lineage. So there are groups of people who may, like, from my standpoint, maybe the McLaughlins in my husband's family might have, an interest in learning about all the McLaughlin, male line. So they have all these different types that you can test. And whatever your interest is, you can follow that for family history.
All right. Well, this is happening in our society on so many levels. And of course, all sorts of privacy and ethical issues are being raised. And one that one of my coworkers just said to me is, what if you find out your family has a family history of a medical condition? Could that mean that you'll have a hard time getting health care coverage? Are these the kind of questions that your patients want to know, Sue?
Absolutely. And that's been one of the biggest barriers to people coming in for care is worry about primarily health insurance discrimination. It's important to note that there is federal and state legislation that protects all of us. The GINA Act is the Genetic Information on Discrimination Act. Tells us that it is illegal for health insurance to discriminate based on genetic test results.
Have you seen that to be upheld well and followed?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There have not been tests to that law that we're aware of. Other things that people worry about is, will I lose my job based on this information? There's also federal legislation that protects us against job discrimination as well. Areas where there are limited laws would be things like disability insurance, life insurance, but those carriers typically aren't overly concerned about hereditary genetic testing.
How about privacy? If someone comes to Maine Medical Center and has a test and is found to be carrying a gene, who knows that information?
Like anything in medicine, we protect an individual's records, including genetic test results. So we follow the same regulations that we do in any other healthcare that we offer. There is a difficult issue associated with that, because if we identify a high-risk genetic factor, we do want family members to be made aware of that. But we can't make those family members aware. It's our job to educate our patient of the importance of getting the information out to family members, and we do provide the tools that allow them to do that.
And we're talking about privacy. What kind of guarantees, Kimberly, are there of privacy if you send a swab off to one of these companies?
So what we've been finding out just recently, and you've seen in the news with all the interesting crimes that have been solved, is that there's a database called GEDmatch where anybody who is tested at any of the other commercial companies can enter their data and just connect with people on a genetic level and try to figure out family connections. But what they found out was that in the Golden State Killer in California, that is how they use that GEDmatch database to build a family tree from maybe people who didn't realize that their family member had committed crimes. So is that unethical? Is that illegal? Not yet. So that was a kind of a sticking point. And there's other, like, just in the recent months, some of these other testing companies like Family Tree DNA and Ancestry have gone to clarify their terms and agreements about where your privacy lies. And whether or not I think a big concern is whether or not the FBI can come in with a search warrant and search these databases for someone's DNA, which so far, no. But if someone were to submit, like there's a lab in Maryland, the Parabon Labs, that do try to do this. And what they'll do is they'll come up with a genetic profile, put it into GEDmatch, and it's the profile of a potential criminal that they think is, the criminal or someone who's committed a horrible act. Then they can go ahead and they can do this through Parabon Labs. But that is a special lab that does just that. And the legalities of all that are really above me, but everybody's talking about it. And there's pause there that if they want to be sure, just read the terms and conditions and go from there.
And you mentioned the Golden State Killer, but because of that case, police in Alaska have arrested a man living in Maine.
Exactly.
A very similar case, and he was just in court yesterday.
Right.
I know, Brandy, that you cannot talk about any specific case, and I'm not going to ask you to do that. But I want to ask, is this sort of a great big step in change? My guess is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that previous to this, you guys were comparing DNA from different crime scenes and seeing if somebody who was at one crime scene might have been at another crime scene. But now that there's public information about DNA, that's a whole different world, isn't it?
It's a different world, and it's also a different type of analysis. Specifically, what we've traditionally been able to do is, like you said, compare DNA from a crime scene to another crime scene or to a person who's been convicted of a crime. So there's a database called CODIS, which stands for the Combined DNA Index System. And there's different indices within the CODIS database, for example, the Forensic Unknown Index. So an unknown DNA profile obtained from a crime scene would be uploaded into that system, and it would sit there and wait for as long as it takes for somebody to be convicted of a crime or a case to be processed, and then a hit would occur. Those are the types of focus that we have.
Right. So you say to be used differently now when, you know, the public information that led to the Golden State Killer and now this arrest in Maine of a very old crime in Alaska. Has Maine State Crime Lab started trying to look at cold cases using this kind of information?
We have a cold case unit, and they're dedicated. There's two detectives, a person from the Attorney General's office and a forensic chemist whose dedicated full-time positions are to examine the unsolved homicides for the state of Maine. I'm not at liberty to discuss the specific techniques being employed by the investigators in terms of how they're going to make the connections to solve those cases.
Mm-hmm. But let me ask you broadly, do you believe that there will be more and more cold cases solved in this manner?
Nationwide, I would imagine that it would lend itself well to cases.
Yeah, sure. Well, we're talking about DNA testing advances medically, forensically, looking at genealogy. If you have questions, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Martin's Point Healthcare, dedicated to providing the highest quality care and coverage to the people of Maine, offering Generations Advantage Medicare plans. Learn how you can enroll at generationsadvantage.com.
The longest student strike in U.S. history ended 50 years ago this week. Strikers wanted ethnic studies courses and more students of color on campus. Things got ugly.
Everybody was under attack.
I just saw brutality I never want to see again.
I spent my 19th birthday in jail.
All for what? Black studies? Ethnic studies?
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. You're invited to join Maine Public at the 9th Annual Thresholds Conference. Sponsored by Hospice of Southern Maine, the conference is a series of conversations about care, caregiving, and relationships at the end of life. The event takes place on May 9th at Hannaford Hall on USM's Portland campus and will feature a talk and a book signing by Weekend Edition Saturday host Scott Simon. Details are at mainepublic.org. Click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Understanding Genetic Testing. Joining me, Kimberly McLaughlin, who is a DNA genealogy researcher, Brandy Karen, a DNA analyst with the State Crime Lab, and Dr. Susan Miesfeldt, oncologist and cancer risk researcher at Maine Medical Center. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Dr. Greg Fierro. He is a family medicine physician and human genetic specialist with Four Seasons Family Practice in Fairfield. He's also been an advisor at the National Genome Research Institute with the National Institutes of Health. Thanks for calling in, Dr. Fierro.
Hi, thank you for having me, Jennifer. And hi, Susan, how are you?
Hey, Greg, good.
So I want to ask about the consumer genetic testing kits and how do these apply to one's health? What can they tell you?
So that's actually an increasingly complex question. Really, the first wave of direct-to-consumer genetic testing came available in around the 2007-2008 timeframe. And at that point in time, the tests that were available provided relatively limited information that I would have considered to be relevant to a patient's care. But increasingly, the mainstream testing companies like 23andMe have approval to incorporate into their testing platforms markers for hereditary risk for a wide variety of conditions, including hereditary cancer syndromes, carrier status that was mentioned earlier, and genetic predisposition to what we call complex disorders, where genes and environment play a major role in the disease, like diabetes, for example. Those DTC can provide information about your risk for disease at this point in time for some conditions, but I think it's important for consumers to recognize that this is an evolving marketplace, and there is a wide degree of variation both in terms of the quality of the tests the companies offer as well as the coverage, if you will, of risk for diseases. So it is very much a time where consumers need to be cautious about thinking about engaging in these services and need to work with healthcare professionals like Susan and perhaps their primary care clinicians to really understand what they might be getting.
Sure. So I'm guessing if you know somebody who's had one of these tests and it shows a risk of something, you would advise them to take a deep breath and go see their doctor before they do anything else, correct?
Correct. That's absolutely the right advice. At this point in time, unless they have a significant amount of training themselves in healthcare and genetics, fully interpreting the results that come from some of the direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies is problematic. I might also add that in the very recent past, as recently as this week, I've had a patient have an experience of a cold call from a company offering direct-to-consumer cancer genetic predisposition. And when I looked into what was provided by the company in terms of their contacts, I could see very little evidence that the company was a viable concern. So I'm a little concerned that there may be some potentially evolving bad actors in this field where consumers really need to be thoughtful about engaging in testing. There are reasons why these companies might like to obtain a DNA sample and some information about you for other types of ways of generating profit.
Do these companies use people's DNA information somehow for research or, you know, to even anonymously look at trends?
Correct. That's also a very much evolving area at this point in time. Some of the larger companies have very much explicitly included aggregating people's genetic and health history information in order to drive discovery science or research about the genome. And a number of the larger companies have begun to work with pharmaceutical companies to help with, for example, drug discovery. I think that you will see more of this in the future. In the very, again, recent past, a company has emerged that allows individuals to contribute their DNA and information about their health. And as part of that, they essentially buy into the company And as information perhaps appears to be valuable in their genome, they and the company enters into agreements with, say, a pharmaceutical organization, the individual contributing the sample actually might receive a dividend for contributing to the research effort. I think consumers, again, should be very cautious when they sign up for any sort of direct-to-consumer genetic testing, that they carefully read the fine print, if you will, the thing that most of us sort of flip through the screens and check the box, I agree. You really should read this when you're engaging in DTC testing and make sure you agree with what the company is saying it may do with your sample.
Sure, and by DTC testing, what's that an acronym for?
Direct to consumer. I apologize. Yeah.
No, that's okay. Your phone cut out a little bit a second ago. I guess the final question for you, Dr. Fierro, is do you think it's a good idea to do one of these tests or not a bad idea? Is it okay?
So from the sort of more mainstream companies at this point in time that are offering direct-to-consumer genetic testing, I think it is absolutely okay. Do I recommend it to my patients on a routine basis? I would say no. I think we're still at a point in time, unless you're doing essentially for recreational or genealogic purposes, that you probably should consider talking to your clinician before engaging in genetic testing for something as important as, say, predisposition to cancer or Alzheimer's disease or type 2 diabetes. But if you are doing it to explore your genome, to learn more about yourself, and you are cautious about entering into an agreement with a company who might use your DNA for reasons that you aren't necessarily in agreement with, and how you act on the information, then I think it's perfectly reasonable at this point in time, again, for the mainstream larger companies.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, Greg. That is Dr. Greg Fierro, a family medicine physician, human genetic specialist in Fairfield. Thank you. We're going to go to another Greg, this one calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Greg. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
Good.
My biological sister did the 23andMe, and she got a breakdown of percentage-wise where her, you know, she's from. I'm wondering, is it the exact same for me?
Ah, we've got shaking head, Kim.
No, it's not the same. If you come from the same parents, each of you will get DNA from each parent. You get 50% from each parent. And so from your mom, if your mom, say, has 100 pieces of DNA, your sister will get 50. And then for you, you'll get 50, but it's not insured that you'll get the same amount or the same exact ones. You only get 50%. It's hard to tell which ones. So you'll get 50% from your mom, 50% from your dad. Then the next child comes along, they get 50% from each one. It could be totally different. So that's why we all look different. We all act different, but we all genetically we all have the same genetic distance from each other because we have the same parents.
There you go, Greg. Thank you for your question and your call. A message from Lucy. When you send your DNA sample to one of these companies to test your ancestry, it only taps into the records of people who have also submitted to the same company. How can you get information that taps into a more extensive database? And you mentioned there is some...
There's one. That's where GEDmatch comes in. GEDmatch is that third-party database that some gentleman from Florida built, and it's really simple. And anybody who has DNA data can download it from the site where they received it, like Ancestry or 23andMe, and it's called raw data. You can take that raw data and then upload it to GEDmatch, and then they will assign you a number, and you'll be able to tell people that you match where they tested from based on the number that they are given.
Is that GEDmatch?
GED.
GEDmatch.
Yep.
Okay.
GEDmatch.com. Yep.
We'll go to Ryan, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I just recently got some information regarding my grandfather as well as my uncle, and they were both diagnosed with, I guess, frontotemporal dementia, a form of Alzheimer's. And I was just curious whether or not I would benefit from being tested or having a test.
Dr. Miesfeldt.
It's a difficult question. And the reason I say that is Alzheimer's, unlike certain cancers or other diseases where there are preventative strategies or screening strategies, there are no preventative strategies for Alzheimer's. So there are genetic tests that predict risk for Alzheimer's. But again, it's sometimes difficult to know whether or not you want to be aware of your risk. So this is where genetic counseling is such a critical component of someone's health care. What a genetic counselor will do will be to address, you know, the process of genetic testing as well as the anticipated outcome, as well as some of the difficult emotional, medical, and social implications of testing. So short answer is there is genetic testing for Alzheimer's disease. You just have to decide if it's right for you and if it's something you want to be aware of. The other important thing is that for the majority of the markers that we do testing for, the risk is not 100%. So, for example, if you test for one of the BRCA markers, your risk can be as high as 70% as a woman of developing breast cancer. And the same is the case for Alzheimer's. The testing also will not predict the severity of the disease. So there are lots of difficult issues when it comes to testing, especially for a disease like Alzheimer's. So my advice for you is if it's something you have interest in, I would suggest you're being referred to a genetic counselor to address the process.
All right. And when you say referred to a genetic counselor, are there many genetic counselors in Maine? Is this something that somebody in any part of Maine can find, only in the Portland area?
Yeah, there are limited numbers of genetic counselors in the state. Maine Medical Center has a large genetic service with several components. Eastern Maine Medical Center also has a genetic service. Those are the two main centers with genetic counselors.
So you might have to travel if you don't live in those.
You may have to travel.
Yeah. Ryan, exactly. Thanks so much for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to Jane, who's calling from Boston. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you, Jennifer, for taking my call. My main concern is privacy issues, especially regarding the National DNA Database, CODIS. The reason why I'm concerned about this is that I have come across, and a lot of other people also have been concerned about this, that when you go to a hospital, especially the Boston hospitals and associated clinics,
Jane, you're hard to understand, but I'm going to ask you, is your question that if you go to the hospital or if you go to a health clinic, will your DNA be entered into the FBI database CODIS? Is that what you're asking?
Well, they're having people sign digitally without giving them the consent form that notifies them that their blood and DNA is being taken and without them knowing about it. That's my concern. When you sign digitally, they are not giving you a written consent form, so it's non-consent.
Okay, and
taking your blood and DNA and doing whatever they want with it.
Okay, I'll ask our panelists if this is something they're familiar with. Brandy, are you aware of this?
That's nothing I've ever encountered. Even uploading samples from crime scenes, they have to meet very specific criteria. The samples have to be in direct relation to the commission of a crime. If, for example, a sample is found and it's kind of near where the crime scene happened, but the investigators are not quite sure, that sample does not get uploaded into the CODIS database. And there's very strict policies on what can be uploaded. So, and nothing from a hospital. Victim's DNA, for example, never goes into CODIS. So if a person is treated at a hospital facility for a sexual assault crime and a sexual assault kit is collected, that victim's DNA is never uploaded into CODIS. It's strictly for crime scene and convicted offenders.
Jane, thanks for your question. We are going to take another quick break. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Rebecca Traister, author of Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. joins us to talk about how female rage, historically mocked and feared, can instead be a source of political power. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
You can listen tomorrow afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. And tonight at 8 on Maine Public Television, it's back to business as we have a high school quiz show Maine doubleheader. Jousting on math, science, history, current events, and popular culture, and then some. First at 8 this evening, York takes on Oxford Hills. Then at 8:30, Hampden Academy and Winthrop go at it. That's tonight between 8 and 9, a high school Maine doubleheader on Maine Public Television.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're talking about DNA testing and how much it can tell you. Joining us, Brandy Caron, who is a DNA analyst at the Maine State Crime Lab. Dr. Susan Miesfeldt is an oncologist and cancer risk researcher at Maine Medical Center. And Kimberly McLaughlin is a nurse and DNA genealogy researcher. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to go to an email from Norris, who asked a question I would have asked you anyway. What is the error rate, mistakes per thousands of tests for DNA matching? Is there a difference in the error rate between government and commercial DNA testing? And has an attempt been made to determine the error rate in DNA testing? So, Kimberly, how accurate is, how are the consumer tests?
From what I have read, there has never been a mistake as far as this is your DNA and this is who you match to. I've never read of a mistake, and lots of people who get surprising results that they didn't expect, they try to figure out how the mistake was made, only to find out there was no mistake. The mistake was in their family tree as far as what they thought they had for family. So it's strange, but I've never read of any of these companies saying, oops, we made a mistake, not once.
And I'll turn to you. How about in forensics and criminology?
In forensics, it's difficult to determine a specific number for an error rate because we don't know what the answer is supposed to be. Unless we're taking a proficiency test where the results are predetermined, it's very difficult to ascertain, is there an error here? So again, there's limitations in how far we can go in making that determination. There are so many different guidelines and policies that are followed to prevent mistakes from happening, safeguards, and there's so many different variables and issues at play. Does the mistake occur during the collection of the crime scene? Are we talking about a cross-contamination of samples? Is it an interpretation error where we're looking at a mixture of DNA profiles and unable to discern a major contributor from a minor contributor? All of those things will factor into the overall accuracy of the results. In terms of, I've never seen a mistake made in terms of a wrongful person is, accused of a crime or wrongfully implicated as a result of their DNA analysis.
Right. We've seen DNA analysis do the opposite, free people who were
absolutely
convicted in the past, but not the other way around.
Not the other way around.
Okay. Right. And Dr. Miesfeldt, how about in the work that you do?
The accuracy of clinical testing in medicine for a number of different genetic conditions is felt to be very high. And as was previously stated, it's hard to know what an error rate is. But again, with the technology we have available, it's felt to be very high. The issue with genetic testing, however, is we don't know all the genes associated with different diseases. So if someone has a strong personal or family history and tests negative for a genetic marker, that does not mean that there's no genetic marker there. It's just the technology we have available to us is not revealing that marker.
There's a chance that it hasn't been discovered
exactly.
yet.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
An email from Wendy. With several siblings and one mother, would a different father show up in a DNA test?
Yes.
Yes, right?
Yes,
and this
would.
Has
yes,
been
would.
A very big surprise for many families, correct?
Many, many families, yes. They can look at it. And they can look at their results and they can find that their genetic distance is different. And then when they go to explain it, it's generally they have a different father. Yes.
So explain that concept. You've used it twice now, genetic distance. There's three siblings and they all take a test.
Right. So what we have is when you I'm very familiar with Ancestry, so I'll use their terms. But when you test with them and they give you your matches, they will give you what they expect your relationship to be with that match. So you might be close family, you might be cousins, you might be, or might be grandparent, or third, fourth, fifth cousins, that kind of thing. And then what they'll do is they'll also assign a number, which is your genetic distance or your genetic measurement. So it's called a centimorgan. And what they do is they say, well, you share 500 centimorgans with this person. And then you look, if you analyze that and you look on a chart, you'll tell what your expected relationship will be. So someone who is a half sibling will have different genetic distance than people who are full siblings.
What has this meant in the world of adoption?
Well, there's a lot of people, especially the adoptees, who want to know, and for various reasons. It may be that they don't know where they came from, or maybe they do, but they want to know their health history, or they want to know, just like a lot of genealogists, where their families came from or how they came to be where they are. And so for adoptees, this is a big deal, and there are Facebook groups that will help people discover where they came from or who their parents are. And there's not many failed attempts at figuring out, you know, who your parents are. There's a lot of people to help. A lot of people are really good at this, and they want to help. And so there are also legal things underway where more and more adoption records are being unsealed. So then they would know that way. So it's, you know, the age of not knowing is going by the wayside, I think.
Sure, and this is a big issue for donor banks as well.
Oh, yeah, that's been in the news this week.
And movies.
Exactly.
And this week. What's this week?
One gentleman, and I forget which state, he had a fertility clinic, and he, instead of paying medical students, which is what he was advertising, this was a number of years ago, but he was advertising that we will get sperm donors from medical students. So, you know, everybody, you know, would probably agree with that. But what he was doing was providing the sperm samples from himself, saving money from having to pay these. And so now he has this onslaught of children in this time span that have figured out they're related to each other. And I think now, and I don't have the article in front of me, but he's in big trouble.
Sounds like it.
And I forget what state. I know where the article is. But it's that kind of thing is coming, was unexpected, and it's coming out to light now.
Oh, my goodness. We have a question from Karen. Do the protections of the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act extend to people in the military? Do any of you know the answer to that?
I do not believe they do, from our experience.
We'll go to Peter, who's calling from Cherryfield. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Oh, hi. Thank you. This is very interesting. We just discovered this year my three children had a half sibling, and we have been looking for her for almost 20 years, and we've just discovered her this year, and she had a chance to see her birth mother, that's my first wife, who's in a nursing home, and thank her for giving birth to her. It was like that all happened on Mother's Day of this year, so. We have had a huge family reunion. It's been amazing, and we have Ancestry DNA to thank for that all happening.
So for you, this has been a wonderful development.
It's been an absolute fabulous development. This woman and my children have blended like you wouldn't believe, like a Hallmark movie.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for calling up and sharing this. And I think it's an especially important story to hear because there is so much concern about privacy and ethical issues and legal issues. But I think many people have stories that are wonderful like Peter's.
There are many. We were discussing it at our last meeting that there are many really warm stories that people have about being reunited with family they didn't know they had. And lots of times you can find service members who had children outside of this country while on duty, but not know because they got shipped somewhere else. So, you know, and now they've been reunited. And I think that happened in Korea or North. There was a gentleman who came and talked about it. He had a child and then I think it was Vietnam. He got shipped out of Vietnam, never knew the child until the child tested. And so that was a very happy reunion. So lots of times it can be very happy. Other times it depends on the situation.
An email from Leo. Is there a DNA test that is considered the most comprehensive for genealogy? And I'm going to guess he means a consumer test. Is one considered most comprehensive?
The only reason, and I always say Ancestry.com, because they have the largest database of any of the consumer products, and they have over like 12 million people in their database now. So it's very comprehensive because there's such a database to draw from that they can make pretty accurate determinations of where you came from, your ethnicity, that kind of thing, and perhaps give you more genetic matches that you might find cousins that you never knew you had. So for me, it's Ancestry, but they're all pretty. They all have their own thing that they do. Like a living DNA is a new product that's in the UK. And so if you're interested in finding UK relatives or where you came from, you know, in Northern Europe, then that's another one you might want to get into.
We'll go to Steve, who's calling from Booth Bay. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I have identical twin girls. They're 32 now. And but I'm curious, if you were to have DNA from each one of them, how similar would it be?
It should be identical.
It should be identical. Yes, that's correct.
Yes, it should be identical.
There you go, Steve. Let me ask you, Brandy, how is, if DNA is being used, I know as an analyst, you're analyzing it. You're not the prosecutor. You're not the detective. Is it used to support generally other evidence in law enforcement, or are we headed to a place where DNA alone may be enough for conviction?
In a lot of the cases, DNA plays the biggest role in obtaining or proving a case. It's kind of the gold standard in forensics because it's statistically based. We can apply a number and give a very specific result identifying one specific person, and with the stats and everything behind it, it lends itself very well to the courtroom experience. But I mean, there's so much that goes into the investigation that it's still only a part of the case. In a murder investigation, for example, there's so many moving parts and so many components, investigative, and then now with the digital information, the cell phones and everything else, that's looked at, you know, DNA plays a part, but it's certainly not the end-all be-all.
We have a related email from William. He asks, has genetic matching been challenged in court, and if so, what was the result?
Genetic matching in terms of forensics?
I'm guessing it. I just read you the whole email.
Yeah. I mean, yes, it's challenged all the time in court from a forensic standpoint, and it works.
And I can just see the movie coming now from our former caller with the identical twin girls, the identical twin who's wrongly convicted of what his long lost brother did.
We've seen that in casework. We've seen, and our reports actually state something to the effect of, aside from an identical twin, this is, you know, DNA coming from this specific person. That's something that investigatively they would have ironed out prior to entering the courtroom.
Lisa on Facebook says, I grew up knowing my father was Polish and my mother was Sicilian. 3 years ago, I did the Ancestry.com DNA test and learned, yes, I'm 50% Polish, but also 23% Italian, 17% Greek, and 12% North African. I recently looked at my report today, and now with a couple years refinement, I'm 63% Polish, and go on and on. How can that change?
Well, when an ancestry just grew exponentially so fast, and with that, their database grew. And when they did, they just adjusted, I think, their algorithms to include all this new information. And I got the update as well. So I think I'm more Irish now. So there you go. but it did refine based on the newest database information that they had. So, yes. And they don't rule out them refining it again. But it doesn't. It's not like a yearly thing. I think it takes a while to do that.
All right. Barbara on Facebook says, I was told my great-great-great-grandmother was Native American. Photos and other connections supported that concept. I tested my DNA and no Native American DNA was detected. Could one of my siblings have Native American DNA and I have none?
Yes, because they all get different bits of DNA from their parents. You might have gotten the Native DNA and your brother didn't, or vice versa. So it's possible, but that far back, sometimes once you go so far back, DNA can wash out and you might not be able to detect it. I think it's like four generations or something, like four or five, six. So at that point, then you have to guess. Maybe it washed out. It still could be there, but maybe it washed out.
Before we go, Dr. Meisfeld, I want to have a little bit of a conversation about hope, because I think, you know, there's so many horrible diseases out there and horrible cancers. And I think that people who've lost someone hold out so much hope that maybe future their own children or future generations will either be able to predict these diseases or will be able to treat them earlier because of genetic testing. But you told me still, even with breast cancer, only 7% at this point. How do you talk about the potential versus what's real in genetic testing with your patients and even with your friends?
Yeah, risk really for any adult disease is multifactorial. Namely, there are a number of different risk factors. There's a degree of chance in developing a disease as well. So genetics is just one component of disease risk. So part of our session when we meet with individuals is to go through what those other risks are. Lifestyle factors, exposures, things like cigarette smoking, those are all things we address as other risk factors. There is excitement in genetics and genomics, however, because our knowledge is growing exponentially, and with it is more knowledge about risk for disease and how to intervene in terms of prevention. But also in the field, we haven't touched on genomics, in the field of genomics, which is looking at, for example, a cancer genome, which is the entire genetic makeup of that cancer. Increasingly, we're able to use that genetic makeup to determine effective treatments, effective therapies that are what are called targeted therapies that are focused on that specific genetic defect or the compilation of genetic defects. So it's an exciting area to be in, and we should see ongoing growth and evolution in its implications.
And do you think that medicine and, you know, I don't know if mainstream is the right word, but that everyday medical practitioners are up to speed on what's available to their patients, or is it unfolding so quickly that there's just no way?
It's impossible for, say, a primary care physician or family practitioner, unless it's someone like Dr. Fierro, who this has been his life, it's impossible to keep up with this literature, because literature is evolving not only in cancer, but in diabetes, heart disease. So that's where genetic professionals come into play. The previous caller relative to Alzheimer's disease, there are professionals that focus on Alzheimer's disease. So that's where referrals to these genetic professionals are so important.
Well, thank you all for being here today. A quick hour and so interesting. Have you back in 6 months and we'll talk about everything that's new then. That was Dr. Susan Meisfeld, who's an oncologist and cancer risk researcher at Maine Medical Center. Also here, Kimberly McLaughlin, nurse and DNA genealogy researcher, and Brandy Karen, DNA analyst with the Maine State Police Crime Lab. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.